Greetings, my friends. Welcome to the next episode of the Mint Mob Podcast. Jason here, joined by my buddy Alex across the pond in Germany. We're going to jump into the usual stuff. But before we do, let's check in and see how the man who is soon to be married is doing. How's it going, buddy?
Everything is really, really good. And by the way, I didn't even tell you that yesterday because, you know, all the time you tell me about you and your wife playing a pickleball. And yesterday I had my debut. I played that for the very first time. And it's actually so much fun, but there are some things I don't really understand. Like when it comes to the rules, you might have to explain me. But yeah, it's real fun. I hope one day you and I, we can play against each other.
Yeah, man. Maybe, who knows? Maybe we'll play some pickleball at your wedding or something at the end of the day. It might be a good time. So, yeah,
that would be great. But yeah, that being said, let's move on to what do we want? NFL? Super Bowl? Did you watch?
No, I didn't watch, man. I took the Jeep out into the desert and did a little off-road trip, just a short one with the wife last night. And we were just watching the score, you know, on the phones. And so we, you know, we kept up with the scores, but that's about it.
Dude, that's not the story I wanted to hear. I wanted you to tell me like, yeah, we went to KFC, got a bucket, and then spent all night long watching football.
KFC, really?
The average American. What's wrong with you?
Oh man, hold on a second. I just dropped my headphones.
Yeah, no worries.
Sorry about that. I dropped my headphones. What you said? KFC? Where did you get KFC from?
I don't know. I thought that was like a common thing to like you know eat chicken wings during like football sessions. I don't know.
Yeah, but you don't get chicken wings from KFC, man. KFC is like you know, like greasy fried food, right? Chicken wings usually get from someplace else, like the local bar or something like that. But yeah, that was kind of funny to hear you say. So it's always funny to hear what people think like happens in the U.S. that don't live here. Oh yeah, it's KFC. KFC for everything, man. KFC and Taco Bell.
Yeah. We're pretty unfortunate. We do not have Taco Bell over here, but
you're not missing anything.
KFC is probably the Yeah, tried in the United States and I didn't really like it. I'm not the biggest fan of tacos, but I have to admit I enjoyed Wendy's, for example. Wendy's was pretty good when I was over there. And obviously everyone here loves In-N-Out for some reason. Like everyone is like, oh, you need to go to LA and try In-N-Out. And yeah, people go crazy about that kind of stuff. But yeah, what shall we do? Like when we you know, fly over, we need to try those things, obviously.
Yeah, for sure.
But okay,
In-N-Out is good, man. In-N-Out is good. Like they have good quality burgers, you know. In-N-Out's really good. And yeah, for sure. And
but for some reason, it's like on the West Coast, you can like get In-N-Out, but some people are like,
that's where it was born.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In-N-Out was a California company. They've actually moved some of their operations to Tennessee because of all the crazy politics and taxes in California. But yeah, they're a California company.
Oh, crazy, man. Yeah, that's why they are probably, you know, mostly on the west side. But then there are some people like from the east side, I think, who are like, oh, I only eat like Shake Shack, something like that. And it's actually interesting that, you know, all these stores are not available, you know, across the whole country. That doesn't make sense to me, but you got a pretty big country. So,
Yeah, it's different, man. Like, depending on where they were founded, right? Like all the founders come from different places.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's basically what, like you have A&W, which is like a Midwest thing. In-N-Out is a West Coast thing. And then back East, I don't know if there's really like a specific East Coast burger joint. Like they're all kind of chain restaurants, like fast food chain restaurants or whatever. There's always local stuff, but I don't know if there's a local, Whataburger is Texas, but yeah, I can't think of anything from like the East. Maybe Hardee's, who knows? Anyway, that's a different podcast, isn't it?
Yeah. We need to go through pop culture as well, man. I need to ask you whether you saw the halftime show.
Oh no, I couldn't care less about the halftime show. The only thing interesting about the whole Super Bowl thing for me was that when I logged into Coinbase, I was looking to just pick up some new tokens, and Like the whole Coinbase app was basically advertising the prediction markets. So like if you have a Coinbase account and you sign up for, basically it's like futures trading. If you sign up for their futures trading platform, you can basically trade all of these different prediction markets right there inside the app. So you can trade all the Solana tokens now, futures and perpetuals, and of course the regular crypto spot, and then stocks. You can trade all of that stuff now, derivatives as well. So it's all right there in the one app. So it's like, again, it's just more proof that, you know, something like crypto and the technologies that run it are, you know, they're just far superior to traditional markets. So it was kind of interesting because you could bet on like, oh, what would, you know, what's Bad Bunny's first song going to be? I'm like, I don't even know who Bad Bunny, I've never heard, I couldn't name a Bad Bunny song if my life depended on it, right? And you could bet on who's going to attend the Super Bowl, like which celebrity is going to be at the Super Bowl. I'm like, really? People are actually betting on this shit? And then you like look at it and there's hundreds of millions of dollars people have put on all these bets. It's pretty crazy, dude. So it's like legalized gambling, but they're just not calling it gambling. So like in the past where you'd have to have a gambling license to run a gaming facility, now you can just make bets on anything and you don't have to go to Vegas. You can just do it on your phone and they call it an investment instead of like gambling. It's pretty funny, dude.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen a lot of that stuff on Polymarket throughout the last year. You know, even things like, is Jerome Powell going to start his speech with good afternoon? And stuff like that, right? Like you could
Gamble
on basically everything.
Yeah, I mean, I knew Polymarket was doing that, but now that, I mean, Coinbase has traditionally been a pretty, you know, conservative company when it comes to what they add or subtract from their platform, because obviously there's legal and moral ramifications to what they do. But they've basically added in literally everything over the last 6 to 8 months that you could possibly trade. It's all right there on your app. So even if you're the average person who logs into Coinbase to check on Bitcoin or whatever, you're getting hit with all these ads to, you know, place a bet on this or place a bet on that. So, you know, they're doing all kinds of work to draw more people into the marketplace, which is obviously good for crypto. But it's in this particular scenario, like I'm not a huge fan of gambling, but this is basically what that is. And to me, it's no different than, you know, placing a bet in a gaming house, like in a casino in Vegas or whatever. But for whatever reason, because we're calling it, you know, like a futures contract, it's okay. You know, we're just we're giving gambling another cover. And so basically people who are, you know, tempted by this stuff, dude, I could see people losing a shit ton of money on this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of stuff has been happening in the crypto space for a very long time, right? Because trading with high leverage is nothing else, right? Like that's gambling as well. So we've seen that obviously, you know, throughout the last couple of years. But one thing that was quite interesting, did you see that Trump was not really happy with, you know, someone having the halftime show who's not, you know, speaking English and American?
I didn't see anything about Trump. Like, again, I don't really follow too many Trump announcements, but I did see there was like an alternative halftime show. I think they did the same thing last year, sponsored by or promoted by Erica Kirk, who, you know, Charlie Kirk's wife. And of course, there's been a lot of information sort of put forth, or maybe conspiracy theories put forth by people like Candace Owens about her being kind of a nefarious individual. So, you know, like there's all these conspiracy theories and you know, everybody was kind of picking their poison about what they wanted to do or say. But like when the, you know, when you have like this very American sport, which is, you know, traditional American football, and it's one of the most, you know, I guess, you know, forward-looking holidays for most people, because everybody kind of takes time out to get with friends over the weekend. Maybe they go somewhere, maybe they're, you know, hanging out together, having people over, whatever. You know, when you have something that's that ingrained in the culture, for it not to be like fully American through and through doesn't really make a lot of sense. But, you know, I mean, if the Super Bowl wants to hire, you know, Britney Spears, what do I care? It doesn't matter to me. Like, it doesn't really change the way I think of it. It just doesn't, to me, it doesn't match the theme And, you know, if I were putting on an event, like a very American event, I would want to have a very American show. And, you know, maybe Bad Bunny isn't it, but, you know, I don't know enough about Bad Bunny to have an opinion either way. So don't really care what Trump said or what my next door neighbor said. It's all foreign to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. But I read about that kind of alternative halftime show as well. I think that was like with Kid Rock or someone. Like, how does it even work? Like, do you press a button and you get like a different show or what? Like, what is that about?
It's just a separate broadcast from what I understand. I think they did the same thing last year. You just flip, you know, if you don't want to watch the, you know, that Bad Bunny halftime show, then you just flip channels and you go and you watch it on a different channel. You know, so same thing. No big deal. And with the way television is right now, like even if you don't, you know, like we don't have cable television in my house, you know, we have a cable internet service, and there's like a free, basically like a free television service that comes with that, right? Like you don't even have to subscribe to channels if you want to watch television. There's literally thousands of channels available. So I guess if you really wanted to raise some funds and pay for you know, an entertainer and buy some airtime. Anyone could do their own halftime show, right? You just have to promote it. So, you know, that's basically what happened in this case. You know, they just decided to do an alternative show that was basically like supposed to be quote unquote American performers or American, you know, like more American. And, you know, they just promoted their own thing. So, you know, it is what it is.
I was just trying to, you know, go through my memories and remember if there was ever like a foreigner doing like the halftime show. Sure. I think it was never like someone not speaking English, right?
I'm sure. I mean, there's always been people who were, you know, not necessarily like American citizens performing. Like, you know, you could have any rock band, you know, from Canada or from the UK or from wherever, you know, or some performer from whatever country. I mean, it doesn't really matter, I don't think. I think right now it's just heightened because of all the division, because all the political division. It's just something else for people to bitch and moan about, you know? And, like, you know, like I said, on the spaces, like, you know, in North America where everyone is really, really spoiled, if we're being honest, I mean, everyone here lives really well. You know, if this is what we have to bitch and moan about, then, you know, people are going to find something to complain about. You know, it's kind of sad, to be honest with you. And it takes away from the event, in my opinion. But I think really a lot of it just has to do with social media gossip and, you know, like clickbaity type headlines and that sort of thing. Because obviously when you see these clickbaity headlines, if you do follow the link and go and you read the article or you watch the video, it's never as bad or as, you know, as energetic or as fiery as the headline makes it seem, right? And this is just good marketing. It's good copywriting. Like you're trying to get the click. Okay, cool. Let me have this really controversial headline or this really fiery headline or whatever. And then you go and read it. It's like, well, you know, I kind of expected whoever to say that. That's kind of what they do. Or, you know, I kind of expected this to be the gist of it. That's kind of what this person's about or what this, you know, event is for. It's really never all that shocking. You know, it's just we live in an attention-based economy and people are monetizing attention to the best of their ability. And they're really good copywriters in the world and they will write good headlines and get people all riled up. And the next thing you know, in a highly charged emotional environment, you have division. And it's, again, us versus them is one of the most powerful narratives to get people fired up. And that's what we've had now for, literally decades. So it's, you know, it is what it is, but I don't get sucked into all that stuff. Like I said, I was out in the desert and the sun had gone down and my wife and I were just staring at a black sky full of stars, man, completely at peace and enjoying the night. And if somebody wants to get pissed off about a halftime show, hey, more power to you, but life's too short, man. I'm going to do something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I would have preferred the night you had as well. But yeah, still, congratulations to the Seahawks. Mark had probably had a pretty great day. And let's see what happens next year. But for now, is it like, do they hold the title now or something? Like they're the current Super Bowl winners, right?
Super Bowl champions, man.
Or is it like champions, okay.
Yeah, Super Bowl champions.
Yeah, it's like every year you see the same conversation, you know, come up in cryptos or in Twitter. Like people are like, okay, what's like the biggest sports event in the world? Is it like the Super Bowl or the World Cup final? And this is like always like the discussions. And it doesn't even matter. Like how can that matter? It doesn't matter. Like watch what you want. And like who cares which one is bigger, right?
Well, I mean, to the rest of the world, obviously soccer is, or football, you know, is a huge deal. But here in the U.S., it's just not. You know, everybody here is raised on American-style football, contact, and the whole nine. And it starts when you're really, really young. So, you know, for people who are socialized in that environment, raised up to, you know, watch football with dad or play football with your friends on the weekends or whatever, you know, the Super Bowl is a big deal. You don't even know that soccer exists. But of course, the rest of the world plays soccer, and you know some of the largest soccer stadiums, you know, would dwarf the population of people who sat and watched the Super Bowl. And to be honest with you, like even professional football here, if you look at the size of the stadiums, college football stadiums here, most of them are way larger than most professional stadiums. You know, like my college football stadium seats almost 100,000 people. You know, and the professional stadium here seats like 65 or 70, you know. So college football stadiums are huge. Like the pageantry and the tradition around that is just such a huge thing. I think Tennessee seats like 103,000, you know. So like it's insane the amount of interest. And these, you know, these college football games sell out left and right. But, you know, you couldn't pay someone to go watch a college soccer game. It's like almost no one goes to these things, right? Like, you know, you go there and the seats are basically empty. And I mean, it's changed over the years. You know, I think when I was in high school, we were the first high school team, the first high school soccer team to ever exist at my school. And of course, you know, when we started playing, other people started playing and they started developing farm teams. And so there was more interest in it, you know, as I got older and as younger kids came through and we played club ball year round. But, you know, if you're American, like you barely know soccer exists, you know, outside of your local community. And if you've not watched something like the World Cup or like a, you know, like a FIFA championship or final or something like that, you know, or Champions League in Europe or whatever. I mean, you don't know the sheer like volume of people that those events draw, but they draw like way more people than like your average professional football game would. It's just that in the US where you've got the power of the purse and the power of the media behind it, it makes it seem like it's a much bigger thing.
Yeah, but I still feel like the comparison is a little bit unfair, right? Because, you know, the World Cup supporters are always like, look at the audiences. You have like, I think you have like 10 times the amount of like viewers on the World Cup final compared to the Super Bowl. But the Super Bowl is like only the American League, right? Like the NFL. And while you have like on the World Cup, you have all the countries coming with their teams. And it makes sense that, you know, more people are watching the finals. But I'm actually excited for the World Cup this year because it takes place in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And I'm like, yeah, I want to see if people are interested or not. Like if when I see the images or the pictures on the television, if there are actually many, you know, people from the United States caring about that event or not. But yeah. Interesting, because I think it's been a while since, you know, such a big soccer event was like in the United States. Mm-hmm. You probably can't even remember, right?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, just think about like the biggest matches, right? You know, you got like, what is the most attended or the single largest World Cup match was what, like 170 some odd thousand people in Brazil, right? Like that's more than...
You mean like in the stadium?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that was like way back in 1950 or something like that, you know. What's the Super Bowl attendance? I'm just curious. Let me see how many people went to the Super Bowl. Let's see, Super Bowl. Let's
see. I mean, that always depends on the stadium, right? Because it's sold out anyway.
Yeah, but most of the professional stadiums, like I was saying, they're smaller than some of the largest college stadiums, right? So let's just see. I'm curious how many tickets were sold for Super Bowl. What is it, 60? Yeah, so like last year's Super Bowl had 65,000 fans in New Orleans, right? The highest attended Super Bowl was way back in 1980, and that was 103,000 people. So the largest World Cup match is almost double the largest Super Bowl event ever.
Yeah, but you can't compare that, because if you had a bigger stadium, they would sell out as well and could get more viewers. Obviously, you need to compare, you know, people actually watching in front of the TV as well.
Well, you do have bigger stadiums. That's what I'm saying. Like, there are other stadiums that they can use. You know, just like this year, they sold, whatever, 60 or 70,000 seats, right? Or last year, 65,000. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the largest, let's see, what's the largest college football stadium? Let's see, largest...
Okay, so one second. So if Seahawks play against Patriots, who are like the opponents, yeah. Patriots, right?
Yeah.
If they play each other, doesn't that mean that, you know, they need to use one of their stadiums?
No, it doesn't have to be that. I mean, like, this game was played in like Santa Rosa, California. It's neutral ground, basically. It's whoever is going to buy the rights and bid for the game, right, is basically what it comes down to. And so, like, the largest college football stadium on record right now is in Michigan, and that's 107,000. So almost double what the, you know, most Super Bowls, what most professional stadiums hold, right? So they could easily hold it there and sell more tickets if they wanted to, right? So, I mean, I hear what you're saying in terms of, like, stadium size, but, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, when you have when you have the power to create the exposure with big dollars, like big advertising dollars, and the media machine behind you, I mean, you can make the event seem like it's the biggest thing on planet Earth. And my point is just simply, it's not. Mm-hmm. Like, if you go to any college football game, like in my hometown, just outside of Athens, Georgia, where the University of Georgia is, like, you know, where everybody is raised from the time they could walk to wear a football uniform, and little girls are wearing like the cheerleader uniforms. You know, that stadium holds 100,000 people roughly. That game will be sold out every weekend. Plus, there'll be people hanging out in every single parking lot around the entire school in RVs, like cooking and camping and, you know, hanging out and like watching the game on TVs in the parking lot, right? So, like, that game, in terms of, like, total attendance, would be greater than most Super Bowls ever. It just wouldn't have the same, like, advertising budget. It wouldn't have the same exposure because it's, you know, it's a local college team as opposed to, like, this big national franchise where people are selling gear all over the world and blah, 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 blah. So, it's just, again, it's perception, right? Like, so most college games draw more people in, but more people will watch the Super Bowl because more people are connected to the National Football League than they are to your local college school, right? Your local university.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. I mean, it's actually always surprising to me that, you know, such things as college football, like, that it's so big in the United States, right? Because I don't think there is anything comparable here in Europe, because obviously when you play, like, college is not the university, right? Like, what the fuck? I always get confused with these words.
Yeah, it's
like
the same thing.
College is not university.
College, right? University.
Oh, it's the same?
Yeah. Going to college is like going to the university, same thing.
Okay, because we do not even have teams, like, you know, sport teams in universities, as far as I know. And yeah, it's crazy that it, you know, draws so many people into the games. And I mean, it's even like, even during high school, right? You even have like high school teams, and it's like taken serious, you know, by the people who play it. And it's not just football, right? I think football is football bigger than basketball?
Oh, God, yeah.
Like in the United States?
That's huge.
Yeah, like, yeah. Oh, way bigger?
Way bigger, yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's football and then basketball and then baseball in terms of, like, you know, in terms of, like, numbers, basically. And it's even more pronounced at the college level. So at the college level, you've got football, which basically pays for everything. And then you've got basketball, which pays for some things. And then baseball, almost nobody goes to, like, a college baseball game.
But isn't it that, like, it's actually so funny. Oh, wait. It's actually so funny that, you know, the United States got obviously football, which is like almost exclusively played in the United States. Obviously, we got rugby, but it's, you know, American football is a little different still. And then we got baseball. I don't think any other country plays baseball, right? And to be honest, like, I tried watching a game once, and it's not that entertaining, to be honest. Like, I'm not sure if I didn't get it, but it took years until the game was finished, and I didn't, you know, get the rules with the innings and all that stuff. And yeah, it's actually interesting to see that these sports are so big in the United States, but, you know, nowhere else, you know, except for basketball, of course.
Well, baseball is really popular in like Central America, like Dominican Republic. It's super popular in Japan. So yeah, I mean, it has its popularity just like every other place does, but, you know, it's not as widespread as like some of the other sports, but because the other countries have different versions of baseball, you know. You might call it mm-hmm. cricket, you know, like cricket is very similar to baseball. It's not the mm-hmm. same thing, but it's similar, you know, so you're going to play that in like, you know, like in the Indian continent, that sort of thing, in the Indian countries, a lot of South American countries.
Yeah, I think cricket is huge, actually.
Yeah, cricket, yeah, absolutely, you know, English and some of the English countries as well. But, I mean, again, like everyone has their version of the sport. You know, so it's they're bat and ball sports in every country. They just may not be baseball. They might be some version of it, but specifically mm-hmm. like American style baseball, you know, that's going to be Japan is a huge hotbed for it. And then Central America, like lots of great players come from Central America. And of course, if you've followed any of the Major League Baseball, you'll see a lot of Japanese names in the starting lineup. Lots of great players come from Japan.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all right, man. Let's get back to topic. Not that we've
been on topic. Let's start the podcast.
yeah, let's start. So one thing we wanted to jump in and then speak a little bit about is the conversation we had last Friday on Spaces when we were speaking about creating your personal galleries, and we had Paul Charles and Sandra on the podcast and on Spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously for you and me, when we speak about the galleries, you know, I remember when you started the archive that you got and started, you know, curating art. And it totally made sense to me because obviously we share the same values and we got, you know, similar ideas often. And I understood what you wanted to do. But I felt like, you know, it makes so much sense, and I didn't really think about, you know, artists who could be skeptical about that idea because obviously they have, you know, handled things differently until now. So I listened back to the episode and I just tried to note, you know, the concerns artists had and wanted to give us another chance to make everything clear and on point because, you know, when on Spaces, so many people, you know, speak and it kind of gets confusing after some time. So I'll just start with the first concern. I think Sandra mentioned, and I felt like that she, for some reason, felt like she's giving up creative control when someone else mints a piece of her. And, you know, for some reason, I think maybe unconsciously, but it felt like she equates minting with authorship. And yeah, we try to explain that, you know, the reality actually is that minting defines ownership and not authorship, right? Authorship lives in the artwork, obviously, the, you know, the attribution and not like who presses the mint button. And so I think what you try to explain or clearly separate was like that ownership does not equal authorship and not, you know, getting IP rights or anything. I think you put it in pretty good words. Like what does it mean for an artist to let anyone else mint a piece from them?
Well, I think you summed it up, really. I didn't use those terms, but I'm going to. I'm going to steal those terms now that you have used them. Ownership and authorship. Yeah, two different things. Authorship has to do with your rights as a creator, of course. Like, and when you create a thing and you fix it into a format that is presentable, then it's yours. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have some proof of that, it's always going to be yours. And I made the example of one of my music publishing clients who, when they, you know, finalize a song, they record a song, they submit that to the U.S. Library of Congress, and that basically, you know, date stamps and guarantees that they have ownership in that publication. And so basically NFTs are kind of doing the same thing. The original song lives on a master in their studio that they have proof and a physical copy of. And then there's a date stamp in the U.S. Library of Congress that says, hey, we created this and, you know, go ahead and archive that for us, you know, put it on your registry for us, right? NFTs are kind of doing the same thing. If you're an artist and you create a piece, it doesn't matter who mints it. It doesn't matter where it gets minted. It doesn't matter where it's duplicated or copied. As long as you've got the master and you've got some proof that you've created that as a master, it's always yours, and it can never be un-yours unless you sell those rights, right? You know, a lot of the questions were circular and repetitive. I think there was just like I think initially the thought was, well, this doesn't make any sense to me as an artist, so let me just ask these questions and that'll clarify the fact that it doesn't make any sense, and everyone will understand that it doesn't make any sense, and let's just not do this. But the truth is, like, mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense. Like, you would never go to an art gallery, buy a piece of art, and then leave it at the gallery. That doesn't make any sense. And in the sense of NFTs, what artists have been doing is they've been minting pieces into a collection that they control. So like they're creating pieces and putting them in their own little galleries online, and then they want you to pay for it. So like I'm gonna pay for it. I'm gonna buy the piece from you, but it's gonna stay in your collection, which makes no sense. So like if you're the artist and I'm the buyer and you have a collection of pieces, specifically one-off pieces. I'm not talking about building a collection, but specifically one-off pieces. Like if you're building one-off art pieces and you're selling these as an artist would in a public forum, when someone buys that, they take it with them and they take it into their domain and you never see it again. Unless it comes back to you or you buy it back, you never see it again. You don't have control of it. You don't have anything to do with it. And it is no longer yours, right? But in NFTs, what we've taught artists with some of these platforms, and I get why, because like it's so complicated to mint anything on chain on anywhere really, is we've created these little sort of online areas where artists can mint their own work into a space that they control, and then you go and buy it, and it shows up like a token in your wallet. Like, all right, I own this token, but you don't actually own anything. You don't own the copyright. You don't own the IP. And you don't even own the original piece. The original piece is sitting in the collection of the original artist. So it's the same as going into a gallery and buying a piece of artwork and then leaving and just leaving the artwork that you purchased on the wall at the gallery. It's what it's equivalent to because you don't have any control. And so when we're talking about ownership, we're talking about the relationship that the buyer and the seller have, or the buyer or the owner has with the piece of property itself. And if your relationship to the property can be violated, then you do not own it. And this is the problem that you run into with one-off works. So if I buy a one-off work and it's not sitting in a space that I control, meaning someone else can go in and violate my relationship with that property, then I haven't bought anything. I've just given an artist my money and it shows up in my wallet, but they can do whatever they want to on their end, and I might wake up one day and it's gone. So that's a very different scenario from having like a collection. You know, I'm not advocating breaking up a collection. So if you're an artist creating a collection of pieces, just like if you were, you know, Topps baseball cards from 1964, and you have a collection of every baseball card of every player on every team, you don't want to break that collection up, right? You want to keep it together because it being together is what its value is. You know, you don't want to break up like... you would never go to like a major collection and say, I want to take this piece out of this major collection, burn it there, and then mint it into my own, because then the collection would be like, well, what's the point of that? Like, we have rarity set up here. we have a little game set up here where we're actually working together to acquire certain pieces or bring certain pieces to life within the confines of the rules of this collection that we've built, right? This is what we're doing. This is the purpose of it. But that's very different from an artist who's doing one-off works or even commissioned works. In the real world, those works are meant to go into the world and out of the artist's hands and live in a domain that that artist doesn't control. So it's two very different scenarios. And so I'm only advocating this for one-off works. You know, so if you're an artist who has a collection that you want to build, this would not apply to you, because obviously keeping the collection as a collection is more valuable than breaking it up.
Yep. And it's actually so funny that we spend so much time on spaces, you know, speaking about IP rights and you know, I felt like that was also another concern she had, that she, you know, that you know, allowing collectors to mint means giving up copyright, commercial rights, or, you know, control over future use. But the truth is, from, like, obviously, you know, you can always have an agreement with an artist if you actually want IP rights, right? But the model we are building does not force that. So the artist keeps 100% IP, no reproduction rights for the collector, no commercial usage, no derivatives, whatever. Only the ownership is transferred. And one more thing that I think Sandra, I'm not sure if Sandra or Paul mentioned it, but to me, it felt like they kind of feared their work might exist multiple times on chain, you know, kind of diluting scarcity and meaning. I'm not sure. Do you ask artists to burn the pieces on Tezos when you mint them into your gallery?
If I'm putting a piece in my gallery, if it's not a print, you know, like I've had some artists reach out to me and give me prints of pieces as bonuses, you know, that they've sent out like as airdrops or whatever. If it's a one-off piece, then I want it to exist in one place. Just like if I owned a one-off, you know, Picasso etching, right? It can only exist in one place at one time. So if I buy it from the gallery, I take it off the wall in the gallery and I take it home and I put it on my wall, that's the only place I want it to exist. So any of the one-off art that's in my gallery, I've had a conversation with the artist and said, listen, I want to bring this into my own gallery. I'd like to burn it and then recreate it there. Right. And I mean, most of them don't care anyway, because like once you technically buy the piece, you can burn it anyway. You don't need their permission to burn it. So like if I wanted to like destroy a collection from an artist, I could go in and buy their pieces and just burn them all. You know, like once you have the ability, once you have that functionality, you can do that. But what I do is I just have the conversation about control and ownership and building a gallery. And I use the real world example that we've used numerous times of taking a piece of art off the wall in their gallery and bringing it into the wall in my house. And they're like, oh yeah, well that makes perfect sense. And then I'll ask them to delist and burn it so that they know that it got destroyed. And then I'll just remint it on Solana in my gallery. So it's really pretty simple. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if any of you guys have ever checked out an artist on Foundation or Object or wherever, what you usually see is that these kind of artists show whether they, you know, have like a one-of-one edition or whether they have 10 editions of a certain piece. And of course, our model is based on edition integrity, right? Like, so a one-of-one stays a one-of-one. And if you acquire it, then it's getting burned on Tezos and you get the only edition transferred to your gallery, which does not mean that you lose IP rights as an artist, but you know, the ownership goes to the collector. And this is like, as we said, like this is actually mirroring what's happening in the real world and in the real art world. And this is what we want to do. Another thing that Paul Charles mentioned, why not just use a wallet viewer? Right, some artists think this is like only about display and can be solved with existing tools. But the reality is actually quite different, because if we love to pick Mark as an example here. So if I just take Mark and I just checked out his wallet, then I see a wild mix of different pieces, of course, you know, mixed with a lot of generative art and generative collections. I know he has like a lot of, I don't know, Vixens or like the OGs, like the Genies. He has a lot of fellas. Those are obviously not in his personal gallery, but in his wallet. And there's like the difference, right? Galleries create context, maybe even like narrative and long-term provenance. So when I check Mark's gallery, I want to see the pieces he curates and he thinks are worth being in his gallery Verde, right? So that's so much different than, you know, just looking at a wallet viewer and checking every single NFT he has in there, right?
Yeah, well, the wallet viewer doesn't solve the problem of control. So if you have a wallet viewer, and I've looked at quite a few, you're basically just pulling data in and you're taking a look at it. That doesn't change or solve the problem of control. Whoever minted it into whatever collection on whatever chain still has full control of the piece and, you know, could disappear tomorrow with their, you know, storage, and that piece could just simply fall by the wayside. So like, you know, having it in a viewer doesn't solve the problem of control. It just basically means that you're looking at it in a different format is all, or on a different platform, but it doesn't do anything to convey ownership to you in terms of like having and holding that piece as a single entity.
You mentioned control, and that's actually like that felt like the core misunderstanding, which is kind of like the heart of it, that artists feel like they give up control, right? And I'm not sure, like, you know, obviously collectors take responsibility for the pieces they own, the ownership. And yeah, I think that was like the main point that needs to be conveyed, that artists do never ever lose authorship, IP, and, you know, obviously their creative control. And I feel like, you know, it's actually interesting, right? Because we would never get that question in the real world. Why, like, hey, why do we want to take that painting into the living room? Like, leave it here, man. Yeah, I know you bought it, but this is like...
I'll keep an eye on it for you.
It's so crazy that we have to...
Give me your money. I'll keep an eye on it for you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, like we said, this model is not about replacing, you know, artists or platforms or whatever. It's about, you know, separating authorship, ownership, curation, and, you know, letting each live where it belongs. And there we are. I love to get that into that conversation with artists, right? Like if artists have concerns, they're like free to reach out. I think we should maybe have some sort of FAQ when it comes to the model we are trying to build, so people get a better understanding, right? Because we gotta be honest, like we haven't really provided a lot of information on what we do. Obviously, you know, we are still in the early phase of, you know, creating the first galleries. But I get that why artists come around and are concerned about what we do, and they're not sure if you know that kind of disadvantages them.
Well, we need to be clear about what we're doing and what we're not doing. We are not building. We're not here to build individual galleries for Web3. That's not what we're doing. This is a service that we're providing to bosses and bosses only, right? And this is not for everybody. And when I say that, what I mean is it's going to require you to actually speak to someone and negotiate a deal. And, you know, so few people in the space are willing to actually have a conversation with a human being, especially one that's, not anonymous. So, you know, at the end of the day, this is about building relationships, and it's about understanding how markets actually function and work. And if we are... if we are concerned about the future of technology, we have to look at how technology serves the human. And right now, if you're a one-off artist, again, this doesn't apply to collections. Collections are a completely different animal. But if you're a one-off artist and you are not building a collection, what you're doing is you're saying, I am creating for myself and I hope you like it, or I am creating for the market and I hope the market likes it. And in both cases, your goal is to sell something. Otherwise, it wouldn't be on chain. That's why you're on chain, so you can sell it, right? And if you're going to put something up for sale, then you have to understand what that actually means. First of all, Most of the artists that we've spoken to don't understand when IP begins or what rights they have or don't have or what they can convey and not convey. And they don't understand the granular nature of IP in the first place. And most of them don't have any IP of value in the first place because they haven't built any story around a character or anything along those lines. So if we are to mirror what happens in the real world, which is what good technology does, then what we need to do is understand that if I am a creator of one-off pieces or custom pieces or one-of-ones or, you know, commissioned pieces, that when I sell the piece, if I hold on to it or if it remains in my control, I haven't really sold the piece. I'm just basically posting a status and I'm keeping a record of what I've done in a portfolio. Okay, so your portfolio and what you sell are two different things. So, I mean, at the end of the day, like if it just comes down to the fact that if you have ownership over a thing, then it basically is a determination of your relationship to that piece of property. And in NFTs, when we talk about ownership, like, oh, you own the NFT. Well, if I wake up tomorrow and someone else could push a few buttons and change the nature of that NFT or change my relationship with that NFT, which is the express right of anyone who owns the collection that it sits in, then I haven't really bought anything because I haven't changed the relationship that I have to the property from the original creator to me. And this is the difference. And if I go into a gallery, like we keep using this example, if I go into a gallery and I pay the money to the gallery and I take the piece home, I have instantly changed the relationship that I have with that piece of property. Now that piece of property is under my care and protection at all times. If something happens to it, it's on me. No one else is responsible and my money is gone, right? If I pay for the piece and I leave it on the wall in the gallery and something happens to it and it's uninsured, then I am just out. I'm out of my money. I'm out of my relationship with the piece. I've lent my relationship to the piece to a third party who's not going to be responsible for it. Again, absent some form of insurance or contractual agreement, right? So when you think about these things and how the art market, and again, like we're talking about like finer art, you know, around fine photography, fine painting, that sort of thing, we haven't yet start to apply these concepts to the digital realm in a specific sense, because we haven't really explored what it actually means to own a thing. And it all comes down to what it means to own a thing, right? So all of these definitions have to exist in the mind of the creator and in the mind of the purchaser for it to make sense for the purchaser to set up their own gallery. And so that's why I say it's not for everyone. You have to understand what it means to own a thing. And for some people, they just won't care. Like, I don't care if it sits in someone else's gallery. That's the way we've always done it. And, you know, that's fine for me. Mm-hmm. But for me personally, having been rugged a million times and having woken up to like beautiful art that I've purchased and the bill didn't get paid and all of a sudden the pieces are gone, that's not a position I'm willing to put myself in anymore. And as a buyer of like quality art who's spending, you know, literally thousands of dollars on art every single year, I want that to be in a space that I own and control. And, you know, when it comes to IP, I'm not asking any artist from one-off creations for IP. I don't ask for IP. It's not even part of the conversation. It's just, can I own this specific piece in my gallery solely? And would you mind if we burned it on this chain and minted it on this chain in my collection so that I can truly state that I own it? And every artist, when I go through the example of, you know, you wouldn't buy a piece and leave it on the wall in the gallery, it doesn't make any sense. They're like, yeah, I get it. That doesn't make any sense. And then the only other obstacle is royalties. So when it comes to royalties on Solana, especially with the Metaplex Core technology, the beautiful thing is if you make a royalties agreement with the artist, you can give royalties, specific royalties to specific people on specific pieces. So it doesn't have to be bound to the collection at the collection level. It can be bound to the NFT at the individual NFT level, which is absolutely beautiful. So if an artist says, yeah, I have no issues with that whatsoever, but I want to make sure that I get commissions every time it sells, right? then I say, okay, well, if I want it bad enough, I'll go ahead and I'll write a little piece of code that gives them royalties, and then we'll do the deal. And if I don't want it bad enough, I'll just say, okay, I get it. I understand that. It's, you know, it's probably not the right deal. So why don't we just move on, or whatever the case may be. But again, it just comes down to like serving the collector and also serving the creator, because in a transaction, both sides have to win. And if I buy something from you and at any point you can take it from me, I haven't really bought it from you, which sets us both up for failure, because your reputation would be damaged and my collection would be damaged, and neither of us is going to win in a scenario like that. So, you know, that's kind of it at the highest level, really.
Yeah, good points, definitely. So if any artist raises another concern in the next weeks or month, I'll clip the last 7 minutes and I'll just send it over to them, because yeah, that was basically it in a nutshell. And I still feel like we need to get some clarity on the whole, you know, intellectual property thing. And I really want to have Scott on Spaces once, and you know, make things clear once and for all. So because I feel like there is still a lot of confusion in the space when it comes to IP, and people have, you know, wrong thoughts on, you know, the whole what IP is and what is needed to transfer IP and all that stuff. So yeah, would love to have Metalhead, aka Scott, on a space and yeah, jump a little bit into the whole IP topic, because we were fortunate enough that he, who was also an artist incubator artist, kind of went over our agreement that we have with artists and kind of, you know, revamped it and did some improvements. So that should definitely be good. And like I said, I'd love to have him on Spaces one day.
Yeah, we should definitely do that.
Like I think we mentioned it like once or twice, but I know Scott is really busy, but I think one day we can get him on Spaces, and if not, maybe on podcast. That would be great as well.
Yeah, and, definitely.
So let's also jump a little bit into what comes in the next 1 or 2 weeks, because we obviously got the core distribution going on right now. The first pieces should go out this week, so if you submitted your pieces, I'll obviously announce it in the Discord as well. But by next weekend you should have the first pieces in your wallets. And then we have the first drop of the year coming up on February 20, which is in 11 days actually, and this is going to be extra special. You know, whenever I get in touch with an artist incubator artist, and you know, I get the artwork and I send it over to Jason, I can see from his reaction how he likes it. And this time it was really special. Like, I could hear in the tone of his voice that this piece is pretty good, isn't it?
Oh, this piece is fantastic. Yeah, it's really, really well done. And no one in their right mind is going to be disappointed by this piece, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And Viorica is going to participate on Friday Spaces. And yeah, talk a little bit about her journey as an artist, maybe about the piece, of course. And it's always so interesting and exciting to see, because I don't like... Obviously, I give artists creative freedom for whatever they want to do. And, you know, sometimes I have the feeling that I'm like, should I like give them more instructions, you know, to let them know what we want in the artist incubator gallery, so it's not, you know, too far away from what we have now. But I probably wouldn't have. Like she didn't need any instructions. Like, what she did was so good, and it's like so on point. And I think it's a great addition to the gallery we have. And it's still so different to everything we have in there, you know, when it comes to like the color composition and all that. So yeah, really looking forward. And of course, looking forward to find out more about her. I'm not sure. I think she's from Russia, if I'm not mistaken. And I think she is pretty confident when it comes to speaking English. She said that she might want to have some support from Anna Shi, who already served as a translator before when we had the drop from Liam Stone. And yeah, then I think we'll have a great spaces on Friday and find out more about the art from Viorica. It's always pretty annoying that we are not really sure how it's pronounced right. So shall we stick with Viorica or change it to Viorica?
I'm sure she'll correct us. I think we're pretty close based on the spelling, but who knows? But yeah, it'll be good. And we can dive into some really cool stuff then. Anna's always really good about translating. She speaks English really, really well. And I know that a lot of the language in Russian is quite poetic when it's translated correctly. So she does a really good job of that. And we can dive into IP as well. I think a wonderful example would be if we talk about, first of all, what it means to put or to have copyrighted material created. You know, like people forget that a piece of art is considered copyrighted the moment it's fixed into a tangible form. So, I mean, when we're talking about copyright, which is what you have to have in order to grant intellectual property rights, you need to understand that that's where it comes from. But also, we should talk a little bit about Andy Warhol and the Campbell's soup cans. I'm sure you're familiar with this work, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Campbell's soup cans were exact replicas of the Campbell's soup cans that you would find in the grocery store, right? And at no point did he ever pay Campbell's any royalties for using their exact cans. And there's a reason for this, and so we can talk about why that is and dive into some of these different things around that. So maybe we can archive that and bring that subject to the forefront, because he made maybe not him specifically, but people in and around the pop art movement who were connected with that made literal millions of dollars basically just using images that someone else had completely created. And so we have to understand why he was able to do that. And these are important considerations. And so, at the end of the day, having these conversations and asking these questions, and especially if we can get Scott in there, because I know Scott was dealing with a tough IP law case when I spoke to him last weekend, we spoke live, we can get some clarity around that. But a lot of this stuff is pretty straightforward. It just gets convoluted with human emotion sometimes. And, you know, we can avoid that with just sticking to specific cases where we outline what exactly happened and what didn't.
Yeah, and I was just looking up if I had that in mind correctly, but I'm familiar with the work, and I think it's actually a pretty good example, and would love to chat a little bit about that, and of course, as I mentioned, we will have Viorica, and looking forward to the space. It's going to be exciting. I hope all of you guys have an amazing week. And we look forward to see you guys around on Friday, of course. What was great having so many speakers last time. And remember to check out your wallets for the core pieces. They should be coming next weekend. And remember to submit the old pieces, of course. I know some are stuck in staking. That's no problem. Just shoot us a little screenshot of what pieces are affected and not transferable. And then we should be good. And just seeing if I forgot something, but I think this should be it for today. I hope you guys are not too bored of the pickleball football stuff we spoke about in the very beginning. We got a little sidetracked there, but what shall we do? We are authentic and real. So Jason, any final words to the audience?
Just have a great week, guys. We'll get the workout and you'll see updates throughout the week on X and inside Discord. And then, of course, we'll have a good conversation on Friday. Hope you guys have a fantastic week.
Bye-bye, everyone.